The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, I'm Patty Campbell for What's Your Story, and today we are turning the tables. Don Dale is here, but Don Dale is going to be our guest, if you will, on What's Your Story. So welcome, Don, to your program.
You. Thank you. It feels weird.
Does it really?
Yeah, it feels a little odd.
I know that you have a question that you often start, which asks people about their favorite childhood memory. But I'm going to ask a different question today that looks a little bit at the other end of life. We're hearing a lot about bucket lists these days and all the things people want to accomplish before they go. Do you have a bucket list? And what's on your list still to go?
I had a bucket list. The last thing on my bucket list, or the last thing I accomplished on my bucket list, was to go to Florence. And I spent a couple of weeks in Italy, in Florence, in Siena. And this was 2 years ago. And pretty much had finished my bucket list. Since then, I can't just have no goals.
Right.
And so I have two goals that I've developed in retirement. And one of them is a physical fitness class that I go to 5 days a week, every morning at 10:30. At the Jewish Community Center on Monument Avenue. And I've never been one for organized exercise at all, as a kid or as an adult. I can't tell you how much this means to me, this fitness class.
What kind of things do you do?
The things I like most about it are the sense of maintaining my physical skills and the social aspect of it. Because there's some delightful people in the class, and we sit around afterwards and talk. We do a half hour of aerobics, 15 minutes of hand weights, and 15 minutes of stretching yoga every day, Monday through Friday. And I find that it has kept me with a little more of an edge than my peers. I can get down on the floor and play with the great-great nieces and nephews and not have to hold on to something to get up. And I have relatives that are 10, 15 years younger than me, and they have to grab a chair, and, you know, it's not a struggle, but it's a little more involved process from getting up flat on the floor to upright.
Has this changed since you've been going to that class?
Oh, yeah. I've noticed, I mean, there are little things about age creeping up on you, as everybody knows. Whatever your age is, you can tell that you can't do what you used to do as easily as you used to do it.
Are you going to give us a hint about your age?
I'll be 70 in September, born in 1942, on September 11th, 9/11.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. It was real irritating when 9/11 first happened. And then I ran into a woman at West Hampton Bakery who was ordering a birthday cake, and it was December 7th. And she said, "My son was born on December 7th, and you'll get over it."
I'll tell you somebody else who was born on December 7th that our listeners will know and know well. Becky.
Was she really?
Becky Emmett was born on December 7th.
The PD?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Program director. I didn't know that. Yeah, it's odd to have. I mean, I was here watching television, and the whole thing unfolded on the Today Show right in front of me. I was getting ready to go out. I was taking the dog to the park, and we were going to enjoy the day. And it certainly did make a dramatic change in the day and in the weeks afterwards. But I got over it, just like the woman whose son was born on December 7th.
You said that one of the things that you set as a goal was to get really in good shape. What else? What was the other thing?
The other thing was to find an outlet for the creative urge, and that was this program. To do is ask. The key is to finding out what to ask. And she's quite the talker, and we had a great conversation about it, and I went away, and I didn't hear from her for a couple of months. And I thought, well, you know, maybe she doesn't need me. And then she called and said, "When do you want to start your series?" I mean, it was a little bit more conversational foreplay than that, but she said, "When do you want to start your series? We want to do a series where you just interview ordinary people about what their stories are." And I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said, "Yes. That sounds like fun." Then it hit me, because I spent 20 years in radio and television, then 30 years at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, essentially in radio and television. But I had never done a long-form interview. Once or twice, I had interviewed politicians for the Sunday morning half-hour roundtable shows, but usually with a partner. And then I realized, okay, this half-hour is on me. And what do I know? What skills do I use? And I realized that the thing you've got to do, and I knew this all along, but it really came to the forefront, was you've got to listen. And that's why I start with, what was your earliest childhood memory? And I've gotten some off-the-wall answers to that. But it's a starting place. It's familiar to the audience. And you listen to what they say. And instead of trying to think, what's my next question going to be? Mm-hmm. And the conversation flows as it would if you were sitting around with a group of friends or with one friend. You don't have to feel like you're working ahead of them and not listening. And listening is the key. It's easy to say. It's hard to do. There have been times in the middle of interviews where I've been stuck. And I've been so intent on what they're saying that I just have not given a single thought to what my next question will be. And nothing occurs to me. And I'll say, hang on a second. Let me think for a minute. And then we'll pick it back up and edit the two pieces together.
The people that you talk to are usually people who are just like us, rather than people who are used to being interviewed.
Right.
How do you find the people that you ultimately want to invite to come on the program?
Well, after about 6 months of it, I ran out of friends because I was interviewing a lot of friends, people my age, and they're interesting people. I interviewed Jill Melikar, who is an astrologer. I interviewed my barber. I interviewed my doctor. They all have interviewed a guy I went to high school with who's a veterinarian and is about to retire. They all had interesting stories. But then I ran out of friends, and I started reading the newspaper and making notes, and I'd see somebody on television and make a note, and Becky would say, how about talking to this listener? And so it's become more difficult to find victims, so to speak, of the What's Your Story series.
Do people ever refuse to come on?
One that I can think of who just didn't want to do it, who just was too intensely private to do it. But that's the only time I've been turned down. And that was somebody I knew but didn't know well. Most people, after it's over, say, you made that so easy. And I think that's probably not that I did anything, but they're just relieved that it's over. Because it's hard to be put under the microscope and answer whatever question I want to throw at them.
It's harder, I think, to be interviewed than to interview for many people.
I find it that way because I've interviewed professionally for years, but I haven't been interviewed very often. So.
Well, you were talking about your friends, and you did not mention friends from either the museum or from the television career. Have you had any of them on your show?
I have interviewed a curator, the African art curator at the Virginia Museum, who's been a friend for 30 years, about the collection's fairly new, and he developed it from scratch.
We're talking Richard Woodward?
Richard Woodward. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him, got good interview out of him, because his life story was very interesting. He had the earliest childhood memory I've ever run across. And he was on a blanket in his backyard, and it was a fragment of a memory of feeling the warmth of the sun on his shoulders. And that's all he could do with it. But it was, he probably was a year and a half.
Wow.
Which is very young to have a memory. And I started asking that question because I had a very, very, to me, dramatic early childhood memory. It was during World War II, which I have no memories of at all. But my mom was holding my hand, and we were walking down the street, and I was wearing a little sailor suit. My dad was in the Navy. So I had a little white sailor suit with a tie and shorts and little white shoes, and I tripped and fell and bloodied my nose.
Oh.
And I have one fragment of memory, and that is of blood down the front of that white sailor suit. And I don't know why that occurred to me when I was thinking of a unique question, a trademark, some sort of gimmick, a theme, whatever you want to call it, to distinguish this interview show from any other interview show. And I decided to try asking that question. And everybody has an interesting memory.
And do you think those memories then play out into people's lives?
I've run across two people, I think, and I can't name them right off the top of my head. But, yeah, I think they sometimes do. And I think sometimes, more importantly, people can make the connection. But two of the people I've interviewed over the past year have said, have told me memories, and themselves then related that memory to the rest of their life. So sometimes that happens. Mine, I was a medic in the Air Force and was a surgery tech, so the blood and injuries came into it in that respect, but I don't think it had any profound effect on me.
Long,
I think it was the blood.
Long-term impact. You were walking with your mother. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have. It's a blended family. My father was married three times, and he had children from all three marriages. And so my full sister, Diane, who is no longer living, was 3.5 years younger than I was. So she was born after the war in 1946. I have two half-brothers and a half-sister. And there's only one of them still alive. They were all older than I was.
So you were not from the first marriage.
I was from the third marriage.
Mm-hmm.
The one that, and I don't mean any reflection on any of the other wives, but the one that lasted. They remained married from a year before I was born until he died.
So you didn't go through the trauma of divorce and being separated from one parent?
Not at all. And I can see that in my closest relatives now from those first two families. And they did have different lives. They had different experiences because of their parents not being together. They were raised in loving homes, and they're wonderful people, and I treasure them, and I see them all the time. We're very close. But their experiences were very different from mine.
Did you grow up here in Richmond?
Born at Retreat Hospital, grew up on Churchill, moved to halfway between Lakeside and Glen Allen when I was a middle teenager, and I've lived here all my life except for 3 years in Germany and the Air Force.
And did you go into the Air Force immediately after high school or college? Or
I went into the Air Force in my junior year, the end of my junior year in college, because I had had my gallbladder taken out, which was very different and more complicated surgery than it is today. And so I missed a great deal of school, and I got a draft note. And had no college deferment because I wasn't in school. And so I thought...
And was that during Vietnam?
Was during Vietnam. And so it was scary. This was actually before the lottery. And so it was random as far as the young men were concerned. So I looked around and thought, now, who doesn't have an infantry? Okay, the Air Force doesn't have an infantry. So I joined the Air Force.
And what was your job in the Air Force?
I had two jobs. I enlisted telling the recruiter that I'd like to be in the medical field because I had, as a 16-year-old, worked at an animal hospital. I thought, damn, you know, guard dogs, I could work with the guard dogs. And I told him that. Well, the medical field encompasses a lot more than guard dogs. And so I wound up as the surgery tech at a little 70-bed hospital in Bitburg, Germany, which was right snug up against the Luxembourg border.
And did you see all that blood that were talking about?
Oh, yeah. And I had some real misgivings between schooling here in the States and being a surgery tech and then flying to Germany about whether I was cut out to do this. But you get so busy doing it that you don't think about it anymore. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You do something, you see the results immediately. Somebody lives. Somebody feels better. But about 2 years into that, the base had a wing of F-4D fighters, big Phantom jets. And that fighter squadron was moved to Vietnam. And so there were fewer people on the base. And that meant that we were overstaffed in the operating room. But American Forces Television at a base 15 kilometers away had an opening. And so I hied myself over there and said, can I cross train and work for you instead of being sent God knows where by the Air Force.
Well, and that was the beginning of quite a career in television.
Well, it had started before. I worked my way through college at WMBG Radio, which was owned by the same people that owned WTVR. So when I came back after 2 years as news director for American Forces Television in Germany, I went to work for the television side of the operation. I moved from radio to TV.
Where did you go to college?
University of Richmond, journalism.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the years in television. I mean, many of our listeners, I remember when Richmond Television was Don Dale, and Don Dale was Richmond Television.
You're too kind.
No, I'm not kind at all. tell us about those years.
Well, it was a time of such excitement. I mean, my years in television encompassed the 60s and 70s. And in the early 70s, in December of 69, when I got back to the States, I went right back to work at Channel 6 and started off as a reporter. And that was so exciting. I mean, I was a television reporter, and I was probably pretty useless, as many of the people you see on television are, because I was still so enamored of the sound of my own voice that I wasn't trying to communicate. I wasn't trying to talk to that person who has to go throw a lever in a voting booth and make a hard decision. And it took about a year to get over that, to realize, okay, your job is not to be on television. Your job is to let people know what's going on in their world. To backtrack a little bit, I was working at channels at WTVR in radio, WMBG, and was sitting in the television control room when Kennedy was shot. And so I had that weekend of just 24 hours, and I spent most of 24 hours a day there. In the 70s, we began to get the capability to have satellite and so many more resources, and color had come in while I was in the Air Force. And so television was changing so rapidly. And the first generation, the people who had built television in Richmond, were still working in television. And so that's who I learned from, that it's all smoke and mirrors, but it's also very important for people to know what's going on in their world. And newspaper readership was beginning to decline. Television viewership was going through the roof. And we had the first 90-minute evening newscast in the city with half-hour of local news, half-hour of Cronkite, Walter Cronkite, then a half-hour of local news at 7 o'clock. So we did 90 minutes straight through, which was grueling. But they were heady times because it had not become corporate yet. Still fun.
Heady times that came to an abrupt end.
For me, yes, very much so. See if I can condense the story that you're aiming for. I was in the newsroom one night. No, I was in the control room. And a reporter brought up a sheaf of copy that she had written, essentially a bulletin that said Senator Harry Byrd had been killed in an auto accident on his way home to Winchester. And I walked the copy into the studio during a commercial break and gave it to the anchorman. And the anchorman read it on the air at about 6:25. And then the newscast wrapped up, 6:30, Cronkite. I walked down to the newsroom, which was at that time in the basement, and asked the reporter, I said, do you have a callback number from the hospital? Because she said she had gotten it from the hospital. And she said, callback number? Come to find out, it was a disgruntled job applicant. No, it was a disgruntled complainer. Someone who had complained because in his TV review of The Dirty Duck, Jerry Williams, who is still a fixture around town, had said on the air, The Dirty Duck is a schmuck. And this was somebody who was irate because in Yiddish, schmuck has a very specific meaning. In English, it means jerk.
Mm.
And I told him that I just couldn't find it in my heart to apologize for using a word that in English means jerk. Whereas he thought that we should apologize for the obscenity in Yiddish.
So it was a setup.
It was a setup, which shouldn't have worked, which should have been caught by the reporter and ultimately by me. But after I threw up in the trash can, it was Friday afternoon, we did a crawl across the Cronkite show, which had more viewers than the 6 o'clock local news, that said we're unable to confirm. At 7 o'clock, we totally backtracked. Harry Bird's press agent wish to God he had had the presence of mind to say the reports of Harry Bird's death are greatly exaggerated. The Mark Twain line.
Sure, absolutely.
But no, he got angry. And he pushed hard, and it was a miserable experience. And that next Monday morning, I was fired.
But very quickly moved to the Virginia Museum.
Almost instantly. I did a television program at WCVE for the United Way that took about 2 months. And then in the spring of 1978, I went to work at the Virginia Museum and stayed there until I retired.
Which did you like better?
Like choosing between your children.
Did you love them both?
Yeah, I loved them both. I loved radio and television. I really, really did. I loved journalism. I'd majored in print journalism. I wrote to Jack Kilpatrick, who was the editor of the News Leader, when I was 12 years old, and said, what should I study if I want to be a journalist? And he told me, handwritten note. And I did that. And I loved it. I had several offers from out-of-town stations. Roanoke, Norfolk, a station in Tennessee, another station in upstate New York, that I didn't apply for, but this we've heard, and if you're looking for a place to go. And
now you're talking about these offers came in after...
After I got fired. Journalism wouldn't be any fun if I'm not doing it in my hometown, because I care about my hometown. That's part of the charm. And a friend of mine said, well, there's an opening at the Virginia Museum. Guy I'd went to college with. Talk about old school ties and networking. And I applied for it and got it. At the time when the museum was ready to explore the use of television as a way of publicizing what it was doing.
So what did you do at the museum?
A little bit of everything. I wrote most everything except the scholarly stuff. I edited a lot. I did television interviews, both as on radio and television as the guest, explaining what the museum was doing. I named the Art After Hours series. I don't know. I mean, this is just to show you the wide variety of things we do. I used to manage the front of house for the Jumpin' Concert series. I wrote television PSAs and radio PSAs and schlepped artists around town for the talk shows and wrote news releases and wrote some semi-scholarly stuff for the museum's quarterly members publication. Not the members' magazine. It doesn't exist any longer, but it was a full-scale magazine.
You introduced this person to Mary Cassatt. I don't know whether you remember,
really?
But you brought one of the curators out to the show that I used to do on WRFK, which was the forerunner of WCVE.
Yeah.
You and I worked together several times
we
during the
back.
Course of that. We do. Well, that's been 20 years.
It's longer than that.
Longer than 20 years.
If you go back to WRFK, you've got to be talking about late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
That's the latest.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Isn't she a wonderful artist? Isn't her work just incredible? I still appreciate... And I've never had an art history course in my life.
How'd you catch up and be credible in that environment?
I learned on the job. I remember in a staff meeting, I'd been there about 10 years, and my boss and I and a bunch of curators and what have you were discussing an upcoming special exhibition. And I used the line I used frequently in those days, the early days, that I'm no expert on art, but I think from a layman's point of view, this is what appeals about the show. And my boss slammed her hand down on the table and said, you know as much about art as anybody else here. You can't use that line anymore. So I realized, yeah, I've learned. I really have learned. If the museum owns it, has shown it, has borrowed it, I've studied it, because you can't write about something without understanding it. And so I had to understand it before I could write about it.
Have you remained active with the museum? Now, you retired when?
3 years ago. So what, 2009?
was your official retirement, or did you tell me that you retired a little bit?
2004 was the official retirement. Yeah,
so you then remained active with the museum.
Right. And a week before they opened this new wing, which was 2-3 years ago, time flies when you're older, I had been back twice, maybe. I didn't want to be one of those people who hung around and talked about the old days and distracted people from their jobs. And so I still see 4 or 5 people from the museum socially that are became good friends over the years. But I don't go back much. And I don't go back to Channel 6 at all. I mean, the last time I was on Channel 6 was because I adopted an older cat from the SPCA under a new program. And the SPCA, didn't you used to be Don Dale? Yeah.
Didn't you used to be?
Right.
Who are you now?
And said, well, would you mind if we booked an interview on Cheryl Miller's morning show, the 9 o'clock show, weekdays? And I've known Cheryl for years and years and years, but that's the last time I've been back to Channel 6. And I've had that cat for 2 years now.
And that's Cassie, who's been coming around a little bit as we've been talking.
Cassie was 5, and to qualify for reduced rates, people who are 65 and older can adopt cats who are 5 and older and get a big break and lots of little goodie bag stuff. So I thought, I'm old, she's older, why not?
We fit together beautifully.
Yeah. And she's beautiful calico. We've hit it off. It's very different when you adopt an older cat because the trust level is not there that you can establish with a kitten. And it's taken her a long while to realize that, yes, she lives here, that she's totally safe, she's well-fed, and that
she's well-fed.
She is. She's a big girl. And
she's not going to those exercise classes
no,
with you,
no,
Don.
No, she's not. She's not, but she's a sweetheart, and we have made vast inroads into becoming knitted and bonded together.
And is she your only roommate?
She's my only roommate right now. The first time in years that I've only had one cat. I used to have a dog, 2 cats. And this is the first time I've had one other heartbeat in the house, and only one other heartbeat. And so the responsibility is on her.
You know, Don, I've been thinking about that question. Weren't you Don Dale? And who are you now? And we have talked a little bit about who Don Dale was. Who is Don Dale today?
Don Dale is probably as happy as he's ever been in his life for 2 reasons and many more. But I'm thoroughly enjoying the Virginia Voice volunteer work. I'm thoroughly enjoying the fitness class that I do 5 days a week at the JCC, both for the fitness angle. My balance has improved, my ability to deal with ordinary everyday life without being worried about falling or something like that is just not a consideration anymore. But also the social aspect. It's very nice to talk to somebody whose memories go back as far as yours do. You don't have to stop and explain when JFK was assassinated or what year the Korean War started. You can just talk to them and they have the same frame of reference that you have, and that's so important.
Well, it's lovely to have young friends, but it is also lovely to have contemporaries.
Exactly. And I have the time now to do what I want to do to please me. Yesterday, for instance, I went, spent an hour and a half wandering the Azalea Gardens at Bryant Park, which I haven't done in years. And it was nobody there on a weekday morning. I mean, it's just nothing but me and the azaleas and the dogwoods and the pond and the fountain. And it was beautiful. And I must have shot 50 pictures. Maybe 2 or 3 of them are worth keeping. But I can do things like that now.
I noticed a book on your table. Do you do a lot of reading?
Yes. See that stack over there by the door? That's to be returned. And it's eclectic. I mean, everything from biographies to trash mysteries. I devour books. And I probably spend at least an hour and a half, 2 hours a day reading now. And thoroughly enjoying it. But I've always loved to read. I just didn't have the time before. I cook. I've never had the time to cook before, to make things, you know, to do something elaborate. But I can get up in the morning and think, okay, I've got two people coming over for dinner tonight, and what am I going to have? And then I can go to the grocery store and buy fresh stuff and bring it home and make it, rather than, okay, I'll just pick up a pizza or I'll get Chinese takeout. And that's a lot of fun. I enjoy that. I blog now, which I have never done before, but I decided with all these little kids, these great nieces and nephews and great nieces, that I have all these stories told up that they keep asking me to repeat for them, and that they have no frame of reference. And I thought, okay, I'll write this stuff down. So I started with my niece, who's pretty good at family genealogy, got all that stuff, and began the blog with as far back as I could go on both sides of the family, which was farther back than I thought, a couple hundred years on one side and 300 years on the other, and have brought it up to date all the way through my life. Talked about the whole Channel 6 thing, the whole Virginia Museum thing, and I'm up to the current point now. I've been doing this for the 3 years I've been retired fully. And so that's there for them. And I have no expectations that anyone outside the family will read it. That is, I didn't have.
Well, but once it's up there, it's up there for the world.
Yes, and I get really weird questions and responses. People will do a Google search on a name, and it'll pop up because we have mutual ancestors. They'll do a Google search on Channel 6, and I'll pop up. Somebody did a Google search on John Shand, who used to be at Channel 6, and they got in touch with me. We had a delightful long conversation while she picked my brain about John Shand. For what reason, I don't know, but certainly wasn't any secret.
Well, if we want to look at your blog, what's the address? How do you get there?
Oh, my goodness.
Here?
I don't know, because it's a bookmark.
Oh, we'll just have to Google Don Dale.
Google Don Dale Blogspot. I do it on Blogspot. So Google Don Dale Blogspot, and you'll find it. I've got a reader over at Heather, over at the Virginia Voice, reads my blog all the time and sends me email messages about it.
You're a pretty busy guy, even though you're retired, and you've got most of that stuff knocked off on the bucket list, and you're working on the goals. But still, what's next?
I don't know. If everything stays exactly as it stays, I will be happy. Nothing ever does. I don't know. Would life be interesting if we did? I mean, something will happen. I will either make something happen, or something will happen to me that will change it and give me a new perspective and prompt new ideas and new directions, and that's fine.
If you had to sum up your philosophy of life, would you say that you've just, in that last answer, given us your philosophy of life?
Oh, Lord, that's so weighty, Patty. I'm not sure that I have anything that would be worth anything to anybody else in terms of a philosophy. But I've been increasingly aware, as I've gotten older, how important family is and how important the little ones in the family are, because they're the future. I've become increasingly aware that I need to have to make things happen to and for me to keep my brain active, to keep myself sharp, so that I don't settle into a rut.
There's some more of that. Something will happen, or I'll make something happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if I had to nail it down, I sound so old. You know, do what's right. Do what's right for you. Do what's right. Live your life in a way that when you get to the end of it, you can be proud of it. And I'm still working on that.
And don't forget your earliest childhood memory.
That's true. A little sailor suit with the blood all down the front of it. My mom has no memory of that. She's dead now, but I've asked her about that over the years. She doesn't remember it at all. She doesn't remember it. But, oh, my goodness, I remember looking down and seeing that blood, that red blood on that white sailor suit. And who knows? I mean, I did repeat that experience as a medic. I wore medic whites. I wore greens in surgery, and I certainly got blood all down the front of it at one time or another.
So we'll need to think about whether or not that had an impact on the rest of your
life. And whether I should continue asking that silly question every time I start an interview.
It's a great question, and we all enjoy hearing the answer. So we will continue we'll continue to enjoy your program. Thanks for being part of... Well, thanks for letting me turn the tables on you today, Don.
It's been a delightful experience.
It has been wonderful. Thank you.
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.